This is Authors on the Air, and I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. This is my final show for the evening, and I'm so glad that you've stuck with me. Nick Kolakowski is my guest tonight. He is a noir crime fiction writer. His latest book is called Slaughterhouse Blues. It is the second part of a book about his characters, Bill and Fiona. I can't wait to talk to Nick because he's told so little about himself that I told him I was going to grill him like a hamburger. So here we are. Nick, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. We've been talking about doing this for a while, and I'm glad our schedule's finally lined up. Thanks for being here. This is what I know about you. I know that your writing has appeared in Shotgun Honey, in McSweeney's Internet Tendency, Thuglit, The North American Review, Spine Tingler, Plots with Guns, and various other anthologies. I know that you live in New York City. I know you write noir crime fiction and that you really, really are very prolific in your writing, whether it's short stories or flash or whether it's in books and anthologies. Have I got it right so far?
You do. I think that's probably a pretty nice summation. I'm also one of the editors of Shotgun Honey, so I am, if you ever send a flash fiction story to them, less than 700 words, I am one of the people who is sorting through that pile, which is great because it gives me sort of a very nice overview of sort of, you know, trends in crime fiction and sort of, you know, kind of what the mass of writers out there are focused on. I mean, you'd be surprised, or maybe not even all that surprised, at how often, you know, kind of the same methods of death and, you know, the same kind of characters crop up again and again. So in terms of my own writing, it's also very helpful because once you've read a cliche, you know, 1,000 times, then you kind of, you know, you're sort of innately trained yourself to avoid it in your own writing.
Well, now let's talk about that a little bit, because I happen to think that someone who writes a really good piece of flash, 700 to 1,000 words, and tells a complete scene, an almost a complete story, is a genius, because very few people can do that and do it well. So what are you seeing in trends with flash fiction?
I mean, I 100% agree with you on the genius part. And I think that, you know, the people who can take that word count and kind of do a complete whole story arc and imply things about characters and so on that obviously they don't have the space to kind of actually write down. I mean, it's an incredible art. I think that kind of the most heartening trend for me, or at least the most heartening trend that I've been seeing lately, is that, I mean, for so long, there was kind of the cliche of the Italian mobster and the cliche of the Russian mobster and the cliche of kind of all these tropes that were probably old, you know, when the Mike Hammer books were coming out. And thankfully, kind of a lot of those, it seems, are beginning to transition out. And I think that sort of, you know, you have this framework for a lot of crime stories, you know, kind of your most basic one is, you know, somebody's killed, you got to find the killer, you know, and then all those other kind of story tropes. But people are now taking those and I think kind of exploring different forms and doing interesting things with them, which I think is really fascinating. People are taking the crime fiction genre, you know, they're maybe mixing it with a little bit of sci-fi, they're maybe mixing it with a little bit of social commentary. I mean, I just think that after decades of kind of a lot of people following the same tropes, now we're sort of seeing, you know, kind of people stretching a little bit and sort of asking of the form, like, what else can you do? Like, what other stories can you tell? What other things can you impart? And that's, I'm not saying that we don't, you know, still kind of get our share of, you know, Godfather ripoffs and stuff like that. But I mean, for the most part, it seems that people are trying to push kind of what a crime fiction story or what a noir story can do. And that's very heartening. And it's also, I mean, you know, when you're sorting through 100 stories, it you know, and you find a bunch that are really good, you know, and obviously that makes it all kind of all worthwhile.
Sure. Anybody on your radar?
Oh, I've got so many people on my radar. The thing, I actually have my stack right here with me. I've got Neat City on Fire, which is a short story collection right now by Angel Lewis Collot, who is another editor of Shotgun Honey,
yeah,
along with me.
I think Angel is probably one of the most brilliant writers around in the genre, and I love his flash. I really do. I like his voice. I like his writing voice. I like everything that he does. I think he's really incredible. So I'm with you 100% on that. Who else?
Plus, he's like, just the other thing about Angel is that he'll take a story to what you think is the most extreme, and then he figures out a way to push it a little bit further, and that's great. It's like, wow, that happened with the donkey. Nick Corpus
right.
is another writer I
like.
I really
Nick
like.
Too. Yep.
Yeah, he actually we hosted in New York City we do a Noir at the Bar, not every month, but you know every other month, and he actually came up from Baltimore and read this great flash fiction piece, which is about this escalating battle between two neighbors. And the great thing about it is that he walked on stage with his latest novel, and everybody thought, of course, he was going to read from the book and so on. And he started the story as an aside, and everybody thought, you know, this was the digression before he did his actual reading. But then the digression turned into the story, and all of a sudden, I mean, he kind of began it very organically. It was a very cool way to kind of get up there and share what he was working on. Of course, I had read the story in print before he got up there, so I mean, I knew, but the rest of the bar was really stunned as he like escalates this thing, and you know, things are on fire and arrows are flying, and like it was a real piece of work.
Oh, that's cool. Tell me more.
Yeah.
Who are you
yeah.
seeing for women writers? Because that is, you know, noir, crime fiction, pulp, all of those really has some spectacular women coming up through the ranks mm-hmm. now. And so mm-hmm. who's on your radar for female crime fiction writers?
And Jen Conley, who wrote this wonderful collection called, Cannibals.
Right.
And the thing about her, which is amazing, is that, and by virtue of living in New York City, I know a lot of writers who live in Jersey and write about Jersey, but she captures, it's almost sort of like Bruce Springsteen. Like she captures these tonals.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of this hopelessness that in every one of her stories just wrecks you. I mean, you know, and then usually there's not like a murder or a death or whatever. Sometimes it's just somebody, you know, kind of being crushed and disappointed by ordinary life. But it's so real that it really hits you in ways that you don't necessarily expect, especially when you read a lot of stuff and you think you're kind of a nerd to, you know, the emotional part of it in some way. The other person I've been reading a lot lately is S.J. Rosen. I just started her book Blood Ties, which I really like, and she's got a great voice that like clicks along, and I've seen her read a couple of times. I mean, she's completely hysterical. She's just so funny, and
she's a great lady
in terms of what she's
writing. And you know what's interesting about S.J. is that this is not her first genre. I mean, she wrote really classic thrillers and mysteries and suspense, and but she's really embraced this little bit of crime fiction magic. And she's not someone who you would associate when you meet her as being a noir crime fiction writer. You know, she's been around forever. She's great to sit in on classes with, by the way. And I really like her a lot. She's just a really terrific person. So I'm with you on that. You know, picking apart stories like that and kind of deciding what you're going to publish takes a certain kind of skill. What is your background, Nick?
So my background is in magazine publishing. I came up in, you know, when back not that long ago, I think we were scrolling back probably about 15 years ago when I graduated college, the paper magazine industry was sort of in its last throes. And I kind of got on to, you know, kind of the last burning train that was leaving that station, not to create too tangled of a metaphor. So, you know, and then obviously print gave way to websites, you know, magazines are all online now, but I mean, I've stayed in kind of the magazine and the news website editing industry for pretty much my entire career. And I started out in medical and travel writing. Then the winds sort of drifted me over to being a luxury writer of all things, which was weird and surreal and kind of horrible in certain ways. And then after that, I became a tech writer after that. And that's what I am now. By day, I write about, you know, Apple's operating system, Android and Google and so on. And then at night I figure out, you know, kind of the best ways to kill somebody with a Tesla.
You're right.
Yeah.
Have you always been interested in writing?
Yeah. I mean, I always find it amazing and inspirational when people kind of had a completely different track that then they jump onto, where, you know, somebody was literally any sort of any other profession, mathematician, mechanic, whatever, and then they decide at some point in their life to jump over to writing. I've always done it since I was a little kid. It's all I ever wanted to be, and I'm really fortunate in that I've been able to cobble together a career that allows me to do it. Because, you know, a lot of people obviously don't, you know, some people, you know, whether they say to themselves, like, I can't write or I don't have the time to write or whatever. I mean, some people only get to it sort of later on, you know, in their personal
yes.
life. And I've sort of been bullheaded and committed to it from the beginning for better or worse. Because, you know, as any full-time writer will tell you, there's definitely the downsides to it in addition to the upsides.
Where did you get your love of reading from?
My mom and dad. I grew up in a household that was, you know, basically had walls of books everywhere. You know,
wow.
We didn't really watch TV except for, you know, kind of movies on the weekend and stuff like that. But I mean, I was, you know, and my parents encouraged that as well. I mean, they would constantly toss me books and say, you know, read this or do this or whatever. And I mean, I found it to be, I mean, it was my, you know, between the ages of, you know, whenever kids learn to read and, you know, 18, I think that was sort of my primary means of interacting with the world, is just sort of, you know, devouring everything I could get my hands on, you know, everything that was, you know, from Homer to, you know, Lovecraft to, you know, Michael
wow.
Hare to, you know, Chuck Palahniuk and Don Winslow and everybody else.
Wow. Very eclectic taste.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really discriminate. I mean, I know that some people are like, oh, I don't read pulp, or people who are like, oh, I don't read fiction or whatever. But I mean, if you give me anything, I'll read it, and you know, I'll give it at least 100 pages. And it's very rare for me to actually. There are people who fortunately have this sort of self-preservation instinct that allows them to close a book and put it aside if it's not hitting them in the right way. And I for some reason have never evolved to have that particular gear. Like, I will read books almost to the bitter end, and it's only very recently that I've sort of coaxed myself into actually putting things down, because, you know, obviously, you know, losing time on a book that's not quite for you is not sort of ideal. But yeah, no, I'll read anything. I'll read a Chinese restaurant menu. I mean, if there's nothing else around.
That's funny. I started the same way you did with my love of reading, and yet I am a crush on reader as well, more fiction than nonfiction, although I do read some nonfiction. But unlike you, I have an embarrassment of riches. I am very, very, very fortunate that this network affords me contact with every publishing house there is. So I get a lot of books, and I really am not tolerant of really bad writing. And maybe it's because I read about 400 books a year that I know immediately when a book is not for me or when it's poorly written. And there are just things that I've learned from talking to so many authors over the years. Maybe it's about voice. It might be, you know, and characters that are indistinguishable because they don't have their own voice. It might be just the first sentence, and something about it says, No, I, you can use the words that you're using, and they're not making any sense to start a story. I give it a page, and if I'm not into it, unless it's my frame of, but you sound like you'll pick up every, like, you like the classics, and I like some, mm-hmm. but I'm more of a, I'm just not that smart, Nick, to be honest with you, to read a lot of the classics. And I didn't grow up reading them. My mom was a fiction lover. And, you know, my first series of books was Agatha Christie. And I read all of the, I thought you had to read them all in a row, in the order they came out. So I read, like,
yeah.
all, what, 104 books in order
wow.
of publication. Crazy.
You should get
you know?
A medal
but they
for
were
that.
Small,
that's
remember?
Yeah.
But remember, those were small books then. Those were ones you got off the spinning rack for, you know, a buck
mm-hmm.
or something. And so you could read them in a sitting in one day. And I guess my tastes are still unrefined. I'm very much a genre fiction reader. But I applaud you for, you know, going through and giving them more of a chance to be read than I do. It's certainly...
Oh.
I'm intolerant of it, I guess, you know, because then I want to talk to the author. And as you well know,
mm-hmm.
on this show, everybody's welcome. Write a good book and come on the show. I'm glad,
yeah.
you know, to talk to people. When did you start writing in earnest?
Oh, I mean, I would, you know, my inner 16-year-old is screaming bloody murder right now because I'm actually about to crucify him. But I mean, I thought I was writing in earnest at like 13 or 14. I was one of those kids who like jotted off some story, which in retrospect was like, you know, cringingly terrible. And I would actually have the gall to, you know, send it out to literary magazines in hopes that like my immortal prose would like be published or whatever. And of course, you know, the rejection letters would come back and my parents wondered what was going on, that I was, you know, all of a sudden all this paper was coming back. And so, you know, and it's unless you're, you know, Rimbaud or somebody like that, like, you know, you're not going to sort of, you need years to learn. You're not going to get any sort of traction at, you know, 14 or 15 or 16 or whatever.
Yeah, but
Fiction
you did
writing
it.
in.
You set yourself up to write, and failure became your teacher. I honor that. I think that's incredible. I don't know that most kids who start at 13, 14, 15 scribble their heart out and send off to magazines would continue going after rejection, yet you did. That's a pretty cool thing.
Oh, thank you. I mean, and then, you know, kind of the rejection streak continued because by the time I got to my early 20s, I felt like, okay, now it's time to start writing, you know, the great American novel. So I started writing, you know, and it was the same stuff that I write now. I mean, it was, you know, noir fiction and horror fiction and stuff like that. So, I mean, and then, you know, and I think a lot of writers will also share this story where, you know, you've got the five, six, seven novels in the desk drawer that, you know, probably should never see the light of day. But I wrote all of
Right.
those, and then, you know, after, you know, and then if you kind of steel yourself and open the drawer and flip through them, and then you sort of see the progression, and you realize that, you know, kind of by probably, you know, the book before the book that actually gets published, like, oh, hey, like this is actually starting to, like, you know, kind of show some, you know, gets its legs under it. So I mean, I was, you know, I'm a connoisseur of failure in that sense. I kind of ground all my way through, you know, kind of writing multiple novels and short stories and things. And then a couple of years back, I finally started to get, you know, kind of traction, you know, thanks to Down and Out Books and Shotgun Honey and so on, and kind of off to the races. And the funny thing about it too is that I was actually, there was a fragment in one of those manuscripts I must have read at 22 or 23, and I went back to it the other day and I started rereading. I think it was the first or second like full length novel I actually finished. And the hilarious thing is that technology has been moving so fast that the entire plot of that book could have been resolved within a page if a character had a smartphone. But you know, in you know 2005 or whatever, smartphones did not actually exist, and so therefore,
Right.
you know, I mean, these things are, it's hilarious how quickly things can get dated. I mean, we read the Agatha Christie's and so on and kind of laugh like, ah, ha, 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 ha. Like, you know, they thought that, you
Right.
know, this happened. And then, but it only, you know, especially at the speed we're moving, it only takes a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, like, oh, you could have solved the murder if you'd only had an iPhone with web access at this particular moment.
Right.
So
You know, it's
creates issues.
interesting you say that because we lost the great Sue Grafton last year, and her character was not aged. Her character was in that small window of years, even though she wrote 25 books about Kinsey. And I always wondered why, and I always wish that I had a chance to interview her before she passed. But you know, she was very happy writing in that time frame without the technology. And it kind of reminds me of the old gumshoe type of novels, you know, where you did the legwork. You didn't have to sit at a laptop or sit on a phone or anything. You did legwork. And I kind of like those books. She was really the reason that I started writing, I mean, excuse me, reading, you know, that genre as much as I did. I mean, I've always enjoyed the little mysteries of Agatha Christie. You know, when you get older, you can figure them out pretty fast, but I like those
Everybody does.
books. Yeah, I like those books a lot. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I mean, it's a similar situation. I'm plowing right now through the Happened Lettered series, which is great.
Yeah,
But
Joe's
it's
going to be
the same
on,
situation.
I think, next week, so you might
Oh,
want to
wow.
tune in. Yeah,
Yeah, no,
I
I
think
definitely will.
you know, next week or the, I don't know, maybe next month. I don't know. I'll let you know, okay? Let me take a break for a second here. Hold on one second. Hold that thought. I
Okay.
want to let you know that since Nick is my final guest for the night, we're going to open up the phone lines if you want to call and say hello. The number is 347-6666. 633-9609. I don't often have a chance to do this, but we have a little extra time in the studio. If you want to say hi to Nick, give us a call, 347-633-9609. I'm sorry, go ahead. You started to talk about the Happen Leonard books. Go ahead.
The thing about, so Happen Leonard, like the early, and this is to your point about kind of the narrow band of years and so on, like the early Happen Leonard books are set when those guys are, you know, probably in their 30s. I mean, you know,
right.
Like one of them's a Vietnam veteran, you know, the other one is.
Right.
And so when, and the great thing about Joe is that he does amazing fights. So these guys go brawl with whatever, you know, KKK member or murderer, you know, whatever. And, you know, supposedly, you know, they both possess, you know, this innate knowledge of jujitsu and everything else. And so they plow through everybody. But then, you know, the later books, and he allowed the characters to age, as a lot of series authors do. And then, you know, these guys are kind of starting to push into Social Security territory, and they're still kicking ass, which on one hand
right.
is inspirational, but on the other hand, it's like, okay, Leonard just, like, devoured, like, three dudes and, like, threw another dude through a plate glass window, and it's like, oh, but
right.
he's also 65. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I think most writers who have series characters, and maybe I'm wrong, but they don't age them in real time, but they do age. And so, and I like the changes, because I also like the peeling away of the layers of their personalities. So you get to learn a little bit more about the characters. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's really valuable. I mean, you know, and then by the time you open like the 20th book in the series or whatever, I mean, it feels like an old friend, and like you sort of slip into that personality and so on. The Slaughterhouse Blues and then the prequel to it, A Brutal Bunch of Heartbroken Saps, are two books in what's eventually going to be a trilogy. The third book is coming out next year. But that the whole character arc for the two main characters in that, Bill and Fiona, the whole plot, all three books, takes place over roughly about 3 months or so. And so there's not, I mean, the characters evolve, but it's not sort of the gradual evolution that you get in, you know, series
sure.
that extend over 20 or 30 years. I mean, they're evolving under fire, basically, very quickly.
Right.
Become not
right.
completely.
I want to tell you that I like A Brutal Bunch of Heartbroken Saps. I like that a lot. When you first sent it to me, I devoured mm-hmm. that book, and then I had to go back and read it again, because sometimes books like that just make me want to sit down and go slower, because I do a pretty fast first read. And mm-hmm. Even though, you know, it's not a long book, obviously, but I like the way you write. I like it very, very much. I want to talk a little bit about how diverse of a writer you are, because, you know, I pulled up your Amazon page, and I have your website up. You know, you wrote a book a few years ago about cigars, and it actually, it sort of says, did you not write a book called Playboy, the Book of Cigars, with someone called Aaron Sigmund? Yeah.
Aaron Sigmund, he's the co-author on that.
Yeah, and I was fascinated to find out that you had written that. And then, you know, I'm scrolling through your other books, and you've got your standalones, and you got your series stuff. And then I come to this one that says, How to Become an Intellectual, 100 Mandatory Maxims to Metamorphose into the Most Learned of Thinkers. Where the hell did that come from? I mean, that's like so off the wall different from everything else. Then you're part of Crime Fiction Inspired by Alcatraz, It's Hard Sentences,
mm-hmm.
which most
mm-hmm.
likely was a Joe Clifford idea, if I read my books correctly, because he's pretty good at putting together those. You're in Down and Out the magazine. You've been in just December's issue. You've been in Spine Tingler. You've been in Crime Syndicate you've been in Thuglit several times, as a matter of fact. And then you wrote 17 noir tales. What don't you want to do? Or do you want to explore every bit of writing that you can?
So the How to Become an Intellectual book, I'll just start from that point, was not something that I came up with the idea for. It was something that was offered to me, because I had written a piece for McSweeney's Internet Tendency, and comedy is the
uh-huh.
hardest thing to write. And it's not something I do
right.
often, but I wrote a piece from the point of view of Nietzsche as a bartender trapped in like a chain restaurant in the Midwest. And the publisher, which is a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster, I guess, had a hole in their spring lineup. And the editor reached out to me and said, look, like, you know, it would be great if you could basically do this book that's, you know, kind of in the same tone and everything as your McSweeney's piece, and we need it in 6 weeks. And so Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, my wife was away, fortunately. And so I like kind of, you know, just, and there was a hurricane, which also helped too in terms of not moving from the writing desk. And then I churned that out. And as what happens with a lot of books that are sort of mid-listers, it came out and tanked. Like, it was in Barnes & Noble, not on that front table, kind of crammed in the, you know, the dusty back somewhere, and then it disappeared.
Sure.
So, and I thought that was the end of it, but then what happened was, I actually just wrote about this for the magazine Fast Company, professor started teaching it in Iran.
Oh, I love Fast Company. I get the actual magazine. I'm going to have to look for it. Is it in the recent issue? I mean, I get their stuff online, and I get...
Yeah,
please do. That's my favorite magazine of all time. Yeah.
But the so it got this is just this weird thing that I only discovered a couple of months back, is that it got translated into Persian, and it's being taught over there, and apparently like that it's this weird little hit in Tehran. But in terms of the other books on the list, like Playboy and so on, a lot of those, you know, and this is a consequence of writing for a living, a lot of those were projects that were brought to me, that, you know, editors, you know, people, they know you're fast, they know that you have availability, and somebody comes to you and says, you know, let's do this book. In the case of the Playboy book, I had actually, even though I don't smoke, I ended up running a cigar magazine for a little bit, through a kind of a weird confluence of events. And after that magazine collapsed, we basically, somebody came to us and was like, you know, how about you take all that stuff they did for the magazine and all this traveling and whatnot, and then make a book out of it. And so, I mean, that's how that came about. But the cool thing about that was that for that job, spent a bunch of time in Central America and Cuba and so on, and then I got to fictionalize it in this new series because they end up in Cuba and Nicaragua and so on. So that was a lot of fun to be able to do that.
So is writing, no matter what you write, it's different.
That's a good question. I'm not one of those writers who obviously struggles with the act of writing, and whether that translates into good or bad prose, I think is an open question. I just love to write, and there are things, I mean, if you told me to write a product manual for something, I would probably kind of groan and noodle over it. But I mean, for the most part, I mean, just the act of writing and the puzzle of structuring sentences and so on is basically all I'll need. I mean, I have a very special love for crime fiction, but I'll tackle anything if it's interesting enough and if people kind of want to read it.
I love that. I really, really love that. You enjoy writing, don't you? I mean, really enjoy writing. When you look at your 16-year-old self and books that you were sending out to all the literary magazines, and you see how far you've come, what do you wish you knew then that you didn't know, but you know now?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would have, in terms of getting like kind of very tactical, I mean, back then, I mean, when I was younger, this was a habit I only recently broke. I used to be one of those writers where you agonized over every single sentence in the first draft, and then, you know, you kind of got to the end and then you agonized through the second draft. I've become a much faster writer, and I've become much less concerned about sort of the state of the first draft when you're plowing through. And I think that has made me kind of definitely a happier writer because, you know, as your guests tell you, I'm sure, I mean, one of the issues is that, I mean, you can get too bogged down and then it's all over.
Yes.
I mean, you're going to just sort of grind to a halt. And I think once I broke that mentality, then obviously I was able to kind of increase my output. I still end up with dead stories and whatnot, but I mean, it's not like, you know, I just have all these fragments that never went anywhere.
It's interesting that you mention that because my first show was with John Lesquois, who is, you know, an international bestselling author. And he talked about that very thing. He said that he doesn't agonize over any sentence anymore, that he's kind of been doing it long enough where he doesn't have to have all this angst when he's writing. It's just he just enjoys it, you know. Are you having fun? Is writing, I mean, when you wrote this most recent book, when you wrote Slaughterhouse Blues, was it fun?
Yes, I would say it's fun. The thing, the part about writing that is not fun for me is everything sort of but the writing. I am not, I will, and I do write all day. But if you tell me to outline something, I will sort of mutter and moan over it. You know, I'm not, you know, and then also sort of like the business related stuff that every professional writer has to go through, you know, and obviously nobody likes that either in terms of like sort of wrestling with that side of things. So, I mean, everything, the act of writing itself, like I absolutely adore everything around it. I mean, if I could have a team of little elves, I would go and do all that for me. I would gladly, you know, who knows what price I have to pay, probably a kidney, but I would gladly leave it to them and not, you know, just be able to focus on writing full time.
I'm going to send you the name of an elf who takes care of my stuff. She's great. and she doesn't cost a kidney. But,
I was about to ask, yeah, what body part am I losing?
No, not at all, because believe me, I can't spare any. You know, I've already had two hips changed out, so I can't afford to lose any more. So what are you working on now? What can we expect to see from you this year?
Okay, so in August, Down and Out Books is releasing, it's called Boise Long Pig Hunting Club. It's a standalone novel set in Idaho. That's an update of The Most Dangerous Game, where the main character is a bounty hunter who finds himself kind of on the wrong side of some very powerful people. And he and his sister, who is a kind of a low-level gun runner, end up kind of having to survive for their lives out in the middle of nowhere. And my wife's family is from Idaho, so actually it's there's a lot of local character. When I was writing the book, she had me like deliberately fuzz out details because I was yanking, you know, the chunks I was yanking out of real life, I guess, were too big and too obvious. And she was like, no, you have to fuzz this out. You have to change this name, et cetera. So that's August. And then February of next year is the third part of Bill and Fiona. And that book is called Main Bad Guy. And right now we're in the, I turned in the first draft, and we're going to start wailing on the second draft probably in a little bit.
Is your wife one of your first readers?
She is. She has a full-time job, and she is also in grad school, so it sometimes takes her a little bit to get to things. But, yeah, she always reads before it goes out. And it's, you know, I think a lot of writers have that circle of people, and it usually the first and last line of defense is, you know, if they're with somebody, it's usually their partner or their spouse. And then after that, it's also sort of, you know, other writers in their orbit and so on. But yeah, no, she reads. Sometimes she can't quite get to all the short stories, but she definitely, you know, kind of reads the books and gives great input.
So let me ask you this. What is the best thing about being a writer?
Ooh, good question. It's so with me, and this is going to sound really weird and a little bit out there, but if I don't write every day, I don't sleep nearly as well. I feel off psychologically. I feel that something's missing. When I do like a nice burst of writing throughout the day, like I sleep extraordinarily well. The dreams are great. You know, I mean, like I feel better. I feel kind of more propulsive and stronger and so on. I've got a very psychosomatic link to this, and I think that when the writing is going well, the best part is that like it internally it feels like all my gears are sort of clicking along, like my heart rate is optimal and so on, and like, you know, everything is good. It used to be when the first couple books came out, I mean, that also used to sort of be the thrill, like you open your box of ARCs, your advanced review copies or so on, and your author copies, and you look at them and you're like, you know, you made this and it's amazing, it's the end of the process. And that hasn't faded. I still get like this almost unnatural thrill over kind of seeing the book in its final form. But, you know, this sort of very personal, almost sort of selfish physical thing that I get out of the act of writing, I think is kind of the key thing for me. And I think that if you took that away from me, I would probably, you know, I mean, the psychological repercussions, I would probably get very depressed very quickly.
I'm sure. What's the worst thing about being a writer?
That's also a really good question. I think it's probably, you know, the time investment, and then either something isn't working on the page, you know, and for whatever reason you have to sort of cut bait and abandon it, or else when you publish something and no one is really reacting to it, because, I mean, you know, the money from royalties and so on in advances is always good, but ultimately, you know, it's more about kind of what people think about it and just the sense that you've had an impact on something, that somebody's been generous with their time to read your thing, and it's obviously caused a reaction to them, but they want to talk about it, whether it's, you know, kind of a review someone's left on Amazon, or sometimes people email me or whatever. I mean, that's sort of, it's one of the best parts, but also it's one of the worst parts when you sort of issue something into the world and it's kind of radio silence, because then it's shouting into the void. I mean, you don't know what's going on. You start to question, like, you know, was this worth the time that I invested in writing it? But I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, it's, I think all of us want to feel that we're not just sort of noodling along in the dark. I mean, we all want to feel that we've had some impact. So,
yeah, it's a double-edged sword, because you want to write because you have to write, but having said that, you want to be read as well. Is that true?
Yeah, that is, yeah. That is very true. It's a multi-part problem. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Never mind the fact that you've created a business for yourself and you have to market it. Let's put that aside. But if you were read and if people enjoy your books, then, you know, it makes it ever so much easier to be a small business, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, I mean, it obviously does. And I mean, I'm fortunate enough that, I mean, I have the books are primary in my mind, but they're secondary to, you know, magazine writing and web writing and things like that. So, I mean, it's, I'm not, you know, there are some writers out there, my hat's off to them, the people who have decided to, like, make a full-time run at writing, where, you know, you're sort of, you know, quarter by quarter, half year, you're very dependent on royalties and things like that. I have a cushion because of the other writing that I do, but I mean,
sure.
For the people who are very incredibly brave, my hat's off to them, but I mean, for them, that must be incredibly nerve-wracking to have to deal with that, you know, and to kind of hope that your numbers sustain for every book that you publish for however long.
Right, right. So you're now talking to a 16-year-old who's got a couple of manuscripts in his drawer. What are you going to tell him? What advice are you going to give him?
I would probably tell them that, I mean, I think that it's very easy to sort of get precious with the page. And I think it's very easy to, you know, to love it a little bit too much. And I think that if something's not working, I think the most valuable thing you can learn, and it takes a long time to learn this, is to abandon it. A bunch of years ago, I was talking to an artist who told me that when she was in art school, their teacher, and this is sort of a jerk thing to do, but it's a good lesson from a certain perspective, had them create a beautiful work of art and then had them destroy it. And he didn't tell them beforehand that they were going to need to wreck it. But I think sort of losing that preciousness and losing things that aren't working but that you love is a very sort of important lesson. And it's a hard emotional lesson to learn, but I think the faster people learn that, the better.
It's really true. I agree with you. There are some writers, and I know some aspiring writers, who have sent their work out to editors, and they say, I'm not changing it. This is my words. I'm not changing it. And, you know, I'm in no position to tell anyone what to do, but I just kind of shrug my shoulders and say, well, you know, okay. You know, you figure you're sending your work to a professional editor, you're paying for it, and you're asking for their advice and then not to take it seems kind of odd to me, but again, I'm not a writer, so I don't know. It just seems like foolhardy, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think failure is a good teacher. Do you think the same way? Yeah.
If you
get knocked down a couple times, like you said, you have this five or six manuscripts that'll never see the light of day, but you didn't stop after all of those rejections from the magazines. And that, I think, you know, is a good thing, because then even if you're writing because you love what you've written and it's not as well read as you wish, it's not so hard to take, right?
No, I mean, I completely agree with that. I mean, I've never understood, and there are famous writers. You hear stories about, like, really famous writers who, you know, will send the manuscript in. In fact, they'll send it in, like, deliberately right before, like, a preset publication date, and they won't want anyone to touch it. I've always sort of marveled at that, just because, you know, no matter what the relationship with the editor is, I mean, you just need that other pair of eyes. I mean, you just need somebody to tell you, hey, this isn't working. And I think that I mean, you also see it in film. where you have directors and so on who get to the point where they don't need to take studio input. And, you know, studio input can be a very bad thing, but sometimes you see a director or a writer who goes completely off the rails cinematically, and it's like, well, maybe somebody should have told you to stop before you decided to do this.
Right,
you know,
to take that tack,
like,
right.
Yeah.
Tell us where we can find all your writing, please, and where we can find you.
Yeah, nickkolakowski.com. Is sort of, you know, obviously the website where everything is compiled together. There's my Amazon page, and then I've got a Twitter feed where I post everything up. It's the first initial and then Kolakowski. So it's easy to remember, a little bit hard to spell. But yeah, those are, I mean, everything, the website is fairly bare because it's just links pretty much, but I've resolved to kind of get a little bit bulkier about that as time goes on.
Well, I'm glad that you opened up to tell me about yourself, and you have such a fascinating history. I don't know that I've spoken to anyone who has been so determined at such a young age to be a writer and loved it as much as you do, and has written as many interesting things as you have. Thank you for coming on my show, Nick. I'm glad you've been here, and I hope that you will come back again soon. Will you?
I will. I'll definitely. Anytime, any place. Just tell me. Just tell me when.
Thanks. Am I going to see you at Boucher this year?
You probably will, actually. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me, because I need to get on that. That is, yeah.
Yeah. It'll be fun. And it's going to be fun because it's right here in my, you know, in my state, a couple hours away from me. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing the noir crowd for sure. It is definitely the time to be a BoucherCon. Younger authors and a new crowd of people coming in, and it's always a lot of fun, isn't it?
Yeah, no. Last year in Toronto, I mean, I had that was my first one. I had an absolute blast. It was great.
Yeah, they're great. And I'll be at Thriller Fest in New York City in July. Maybe we can get together for a drink or something. I'd love to meet you in person and get my book signed. How about that?
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
I really appreciate you coming on. By the way, Joe Lansdale will be on March 29. So just to let you know, and.
Mm-hmm.
This wraps my shows for the week. Except for tomorrow, I'm doing a rescheduled show with a women's fiction writer, and at 7:00. Nick Kolakowski, thanks for being with me, my friend, and you and I will talk again soon, okay?
Thank you so much.
And for everybody else, thanks so much for being with Nick and I. I appreciate it, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, all.